Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals the hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I'm just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. We were here with Kirk and JB, and we did have a good time today, you, Kirk, and I, on concluding the story of Noah and the Ark, specifically talking about why it's important, and in particular, how the conclusion of that story is the antithesis of religion. I mean, it just absolutely destroys Christianity in particular, because, you know, it says that, you know, the reason that Noah was able to board that ark and save himself and his family was because he listened to everything that was said, and then he did precisely, changing nothing, did exactly what Yah had said, and not some of it, but all of it. So he acted upon
God's
instructions. No. And so that's
imagine that.
Yeah, imagine that. Listen to what God says, and then act upon it. Very simple formula, but that is the formula of the covenant. And then we went into the story of Babel and of Nimrod, and it's just so powerful. Yahweh described Nimrod using Chalal, and which is, he's sickening, he's disgusting, he's corrupt, he's reprehensible. That's not a good thing. And he said he was sickening and deadly and diseased and reprehensible because he existed as a Gabor. Now, that should stop the everybody in their tracks.
Mm-hmm.
Because Yahweh doesn't use Gabor with him once, but twice. Gabor, remember, is the term that that stupidly English Bibles are wont to translate Almighty God. It's not the word for giants.
I think it was used in that passage. You're correct.
It's used in the Nephilim story, and it's rendered giants in the Nephilim story. Well, the word clearly doesn't mean giants. It's heroic warriors and successful politicians is what it is. People who have achieved a great deal of status and position and result in government and in the military. And so to ascribe it to God when it speaks of men, as they do in Yahshua Isaiah 9:6, to give the inference that this is talking about Yosha, is just stupid. I mean, no. And, you know, we were reading the story of Nimrod, and Yahweh uses Gabor twice to describe Nimrod, and he says the reason he is sickening, the reason he is repulsive, is because he's a political success and a military hero. That's what makes him repulsive. And I don't want to give every Christian
John McCain.
Yeah, every one of those pause but it also shows that there is no way that is ascribed to Yosha. Yosha was never a political leader. He was never a military leader. Dode was both. The term is not used favorably in most cases. It's negative in most cases. And Yahweh even applied it negatively to Dode on most occasions because it was the reason Dode was unfit to build the house on Mount Moriah, is that he was a man of war. And God was not going to have his covenant home built by a man of war. But it does shine a lot of light on 9-6, making it literally impossible.
Right.
That Yeshayah 9-6 and 7 could apply to Yosha. There are a lot of words that lead us away from that. And foremost amongst them excludes it. This is just, you know, you may want to say, I don't want that to be true. I know there's been a rift again now for the third time this year, and the falling out began over Yeshayah 9-6 and 9-7. People were still trying to cling to the idea it could be both people, but trust me, I don't care if you do that. It doesn't bother me at all. But if you really follow the words, this is one of those few times where I would say, you know, we could, you know, a lot of times I'll say, we could both be right, we could both be wrong, one of us could be right, the other one could be wrong. This is just one of those times where, I'm sorry, Gabor is a killer. It's just over with Gabor. Right? Case closed. Move on to a different argument. You're not going to prevail in that one. Yeah, by the way, there was the rift began, as I understand, there on this is Dode, not Yosha. And so that was extrapolated to that a lot of people are uncomfortable that I am giving or equating a death by God status to Dode. If that's your conclusion,
what you're doing?
Just go away. I mean, you're
if that's what you're taking from this, you're completely missing every point you've tried to make.
That is correct. Yeah, there is no reason for you to listen further. Just go away. We're not communicating. There's nothing I can do to solve that. Yeah. And they say, you know, that the reason that they're uncomfortable with it is because of Dode's alleged behavior. Well, Dode's behavior is the point, and it's not the point. We don't ever talk about Dode as being a demagogue. He's not a demagogue. But he was a man that was inspired by Yahweh. And inspired by Yahweh as a Nabi, that is big time. You know, the 40 people in the history of the world, any better than that. That is the premier job in the universe, is to be a Nabi. Only 40 people. Dode was one of those 40. But Dode wasn't just one of the 40. You could argue that he was either the most important or the second most important of all the prophets.
Well, he's the one that explains the other ones.
You can argue that Moshe was a more important prophet. But the problem with that is that while the other prophets are intermixed, you know, Chabaouk comes through and says, what's the matter with, you know, Shaul? You can't die. I mean, what's the matter with these people? You know, their religion is based on God dying. That's stupid. Yeshayah interjects all the time. And his prophetic testimony. They engage and they inject all the time. While the book of Dabarim is 100% Moshe, all it really is a summation of the important points of the Torah. It doesn't really add much to the Torah. It just reinforces the important points of the Torah. Almost all of the Torah is actually Yahweh telling stories that had nothing to do with Moshe. So there's a, you know, you could make an argument that of the prophets, Dode was the most important. He's the one that explained how to observe the Torah. He is the perfect representative of what it means to be part of the covenant. And he's the person that destroys the religious myth that the Torah is a set of laws, and if you violate one, you're condemned. Because he violated most all of them.
Yes, you name it, yeah.
Yeah. He's also the epitome of the of somebody that reinforces the point that everybody in religion misses. So, you know, everybody has religious thing. You know, I think I'll avoid hell and go to heaven because, you know, I've been good. You know, I've done more good things than bad things. Dobo certainly was not good. And he's absolutely vindicated. Yeah. So he's the poster child for good is right next to irrelevant. It's not totally irrelevant when you're in a relationship with God, but it borders on it. And right.
It's not a deciding factor.
Yeah, it's a deciding factor. So I can't just say we have it. Certainly I have grown in my interest of Dode, first because of the 91st Psalm, which is how I began all of this 16 years ago. Powerful insights. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for the 91st Psalm. The 19th Psalm, which describes the Torah as being perfect and it's responsible for restoring our souls, is probably my favorite. The 119th Psalm is maybe the most important document ever written, besides the Torah itself, explaining how to observe the Torah. His eyewitness accounts of what happened on Pesach B'Kurim and Matzah B'Kurim are the only ones that exist. The fact they were written 1,000 years in advance doesn't change the fact they're the only eyewitness accounts of those 3 days. You know, yes, there's information in Matanyah as to what happened on Pesach and what happened on B'Kurim, but nobody other than Dode explains why and or describes what happens on Matzah, which was really the most important of those days. So, you know, you look at it and you say, well, there's more information there that is useful to us than probably any other place. And then, you know, I just boil it all down to my affinity for Dode and my kind of fixation on him because of all the information that he provides us that's useful is nothing compared to Yahweh's focus and love for the man. And he is my beloved son. I am his father. He's right. That's quite an endorsement. I'm not aware of anybody else that got that endorsement. I mean, that's...
No.
Those three things are the three things he once said about you.
Yeah.
He is my beloved son. I am his father. He is right.
Think about it. Name another human being on earth ever that you know we can look to and follow as an example better than those. You can't name them.
Right. That is correct.
So what would people have against us wanting to look to his for an example?
Right. And what Dode's life proves is that God just doesn't care about the minutia. Yeah, you know, if you spent most of your life in the military, yeah, it's not going to preclude you being engaged in a loving relationship, but yeah, it's not very productive.
It may not make him happy, but
right. You know, and you know, the large harem and all the fooling around, God said nothing. All he didn't like the idea of him setting his general into harm's way because he wanted to have access to his wife.
Another woman.
Yeah, I mean, God was really irked at that, but because that was really pretty. That's pretty messed up. You know, I'm laughing here. I shouldn't be laughing, but that's really messed up. What he did there. So, but what he shows is that it's not about our behavior. And by the way, you know, there's been a rift brewing because occasionally I'm really harsh on people. And it's true, occasionally I'm really harsh on people. It began in earnest on the Moody Jeff thing where I was very critical of what this guy who, you know, claimed to be a scholar who was got a degree from Moody Bible College had to say, and then his response to many of the things that I said, which were just really demeaning to God. I mean, just, oh, hurtful and foolish. And so we read what he read, and I, you know, read my comments. And I was scolded because that was harsh and hurtful. And yet, you study Dode. Joe doesn't give anybody any accommodation. I mean, he's constantly not only talking about his enemies, but you know, asking God to silence them and criticizing them. He is the principal example. One of the things that we talked about on the Noach story, and then again on the Babel story, is that this notion that God is accepting or tolerant or all-loving and that he wants to save everybody or that we should act in a similar fashion is just nonsense. You know, if you're accepting and accommodating and loving in terms of your fellow man, you're going the wrong direction. That leads to political compromise or religious addiction. It's the wrong way to go. You know, we've probably only six people that know this in terms of the person that wrote it. So the person that wrote this, the people that know who wrote it don't care. And no one else needs to know. But you know, I received a letter that somebody was upset and begged me to try to reconcile the most recent rift in the family and say that, you know, that needed to show some, you know, love and kindness and solve this. No.
Not your job.
No, I don't. Not my job.
That goes against everything you've ever tried to say. You know, you are not some sort of leader that we're supposed to be following. You're just trying to provide information.
Correct.
It's not your job to police people, to tell people what they can and can't think or say.
Correct. Yes. And that's half of it. The other half of it is to try to create peace and harmony and accommodation and the like. Unity amongst people is not one of God's instructions. So it isn't even a mandate, even if if somebody were a leader, and nobody is. You know, so your relationship with Yahweh ought to be irrevocable and tight and loving, it ought not bother you that people are critical or that they're not united. It's just really not bother you. So anyway, that's a long introduction. We're going to actually return to the animals and Yeshaya 11:6-7 before we return to the next. That will give us a chance to catch back up in context. And the reason we're doing this is that I issued a challenge last week as we went through this discussion on the animals, where I said my conclusion is the wolf isn't making nice with the lamb, and that the leopard and the young kid are not singing kumbaya. That the adolescent calf and the young lion are just not making nice together. And that this is not a depiction of what's going to happen after Yahweh returns during the millennial Shabbat. You know, I don't think that he's going to... First of all, I don't think that God thinks that carnivores are a bad thing.
No, you're talking about the deer at your property now. If you kill all the predators, then they all get sick and die.
Right. So I don't think God has any issue with carnivores. He created them to be carnivores. Circle of life. So I don't think it bothers him at all that they're carnivores. And I think it's important that he says we're going to be observing Pesach, for example,
for all eternity.
Well, guess what? Pesach requires a lamb.
Mm-hmm.
So
you can't eat if it ain't dead.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a one-year-old lamb. You know, it's not an old, decrepit lamb that just fell over from old age, or the wolf finally scared it. So I think this is speaking of events prior to his return, because that's what he was speaking of in Yeshaya 11:1-5. And so I'll read 11:6, and then, Kirk, you took a challenge to see because on this one, you know, this is not like Gabor El, not meaning Almighty God, but instead mighty leader and warrior on behalf of God. And, you know, I'll go to my grave fighting that one. This one, I'd be happy to be wrong. Wouldn't bother me at all to have you, as I finish reading this, to come to a different conclusion. In fact, I might even be happier because it didn't make any sense to me as everybody making nice together. So here's, let me read it. So then the wolf, Zeev, the predatory mammal, and I interpret it as representing the most infamous Benjamite, Paul, the wolf in sheep's clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the verb is gur, and gur is not a not a happy verb, which then triggered my senses to say, better pay attention here, and maybe there's something going on. Gur means to dwell as an alien. It means to stir up trouble and strife while being quarrelsome as a result of an insidious plan with the lamb. Lamb is in association as the dominant ram, used almost exclusively in the Torah to speak of the Passover lamb. And the leopard, the Namur panther, or a spotted and camouflaged black predator, from an unused root meaning transparent regarding its nature and purpose, will lie down and stretch out, or will lie in wait, couched beneath and ready to pounce, in association with the young kid, the gaddy, the young goat, from gad, meaning fortuitous. Then the adolescent calf, the eagle, the winged cow, from a gull to revolve, coming full circle, and the young lion, often used as a metaphor for Yahuda, will be together at the same time, in one accord, all together in one place, and insignificant, a simple, unimportant, easily understood, or alternatively, a lowly little one, shall motivate them, being carried away by them. All right, so you studied that. You took the challenge, Kirk.
But I didn't get, all the way through, but I was amazing what I was trying to figure out. Is it anyway, and I think I made my first little question to myself, was I'm having difficulty finding any reason to translate Zeev, which is wolf, as an actual wolf. And there's 7 occurrences of this where they use it in everything from Chabaouk to Zephaniah to Ezekiel to Yashiyah and Yirmiyah. And every time it's used, it's always a simile or a metaphor for a predator. Sometimes it even mentions Nineveh, princes of Nineveh, like in Zephaniah, or roaring lions, or, you know what? And everywhere you go, except for 11:6, the translators translate it that way. They don't try to make it into anything that...
it's a vicious
but
predator.
Somehow, it must have been because they, in 11:6, they wanted to turn out to be everything being perfect in this new world, which is not like the world we're going to live in.
Right.
They wanted the lion to lay down with the lamb. They wanted to the wolf to not be a predator.
The problem with that, of course, Kirk, is that there's a lot of Hebrew words for lay down. Lay down and rest, for example. This is not lay down and rest.
Yeah. I'm just saying in the Christian Bible, so they, you know, in the Revelations and all, they start talking like that. Everything is lying. And
this is a G word. You know, G words in Hebrew. As soon as you see a word that starts with a G in Hebrew, watch out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, watch out. Gomorrah, Goyim, for example. G words in Hebrew speak of foreigners and inappropriate behavior for the most part. Not 100%, but most of the time, this is the G word. And
well,
that's why
it's
an alien that is dwelling with during the trouble.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
G is the... There were 2 G's in the original Hebrew alphabet. And and almost all of the things that, like Gaza, for example, was a G word. Gaza really bad. That was the bad G. Gomorrah, bad G. Yeah, it used to be the 8th letter in the Hebrew language.
Yeah,
it kind of looks like an 8. It's an infinity looking thing with 3.
Exactly.
Like a rope all that, yeah.
Right, 8th letter, sign of infinity, exactly. All of those things. And so there's been some migration with the Hebrew G. But when you see a word with a G, you ought to be alert. It's like the TS, the Tazday. Tazdeh is a strong letter in Hebrew. When you see a word that begins with Tazdeh, it's either going to be really, really good or really, really bad. You know, Sadak, right, righteous, really, really good. Zion, you know, the signpost along the way, really, really good. But probably 70% of Hebrew words that begin with a TS are, soon as you mean, every time I see it, you know, I'm starting a word, I go, uh-oh, this is not going to be good. So anyway.
No, that's when you know you've translated a lot, that you start recognizing things like that.
Yes, friends. You know, you just make connections. I've been doing this for 16 years now, and after a while, some of it ought to sink in, right?
Yeah.
You know, well, like, you mentioned it the other day. One of the conclusions I came to is when you see wrong,
you've got to see wrong,
duck for cover.
Yeah, well, you're in trouble.
There's like eight really bad ones and one good one.
Yeah, we talked about that a long time ago.
Kirk's observation about, you know, with the resh, which way the face is facing toward, whether or not the word is positive or negative, that was fascinating to me. How
fascinating.
A lot of the letters are that way, you know, and some of them.
Half the Hebrew letters have an inclination. Half of them. That's really surprising. That half of the, you know, the foot points one way, not the other way. The face points looks one way, not the other way. There are letters like the hey, which have no inclination. You know, they're symmetrical right and left. For example, the LF, the first letter in the Hebrew language, it is symmetrical. But the Bayef is not symmetrical. The opening, the one opening, is on the left side.
Yeah.
It's a little over half the Hebrew letters have an inclination right or left, and it's whether that inclination is away from or pointed towards a letter in Yahweh's name that tells you if it's good or bad.
And usually it's going to the left, but if you put an aleph to the left of it or aleph to the right of it, then that's it depends on what the words that we usually think of in terms of symbolizing the set apart spirit or the or Yahweh himself or the head lamb or the head ram. You get clues, absolutely.
Yeah, and when you look at none, the sperm, it's moving it
to the left.
Left to right.
Normal path
down
is right to
up.
Left.
Right. You look at the lamed, that staff. You know, it's open on the left-hand side. So it's being held by someone on the right towards the left-hand side. So there's a huge percentage of these letters that have an inclination. And I had never...
That's one more thing that makes Hebrew such an amazing language. It communicates on such deep levels.
It does.
Yeah.
But it also communicates on a very superficial level.
Yeah.
For example, the thing that finding the inclination, that's pretty sophisticated. It's really simple when you look at it, but recognizing it wasn't all that simple. The pictures of the letters, even if you don't read Hebrew, you can tell what most of the words mean just by the letters that comprise the word, because they all conveyed a picture of something, you know, walking or a shepherd or looking or thinking or observing or standing up or the ram
or
the head of,
or
you
name it,
a home, a sign. So it's a very, very simple on one level. And very deep and sophisticated on another. So you came to the same conclusion that the wolf is a...
Most of them, but the wolf is, it can't be anything else. It's never used any other way except by English translators. And when you get to Burr, and you're talking about a person who is... as an extension to be afraid of a stranger, or from what you were adding to it, and also to be frightened and panic usually by. So all the words containing a GWR or Gimel Rosh mean either a pilgrimage, a fright, frightening, or panic. And so he's not talking about really worried about a wolf, because we haven't found a wolf anywhere listed other than by speculation. Where it's not talking about religion oppressors?
Yeah. So, in other words, the first two words, Zayab, predator, and Gur, frightening, scheme, treacherous, deceitful, rebellious, inciting an adversarial situation, picking a fight. You put those two words together, and those are your first two words. Gosh, it's awful hard at that point to come out with a positive, particularly when this one that's picking the fight and scheming a harmful and rebellious and adversarial response is doing so with the Passover lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And since the wolf is the symbol of the ultimate opponent of the Torah, Paul, Shaul,
mm-hmm.
and he was specifically a wolf in sheep's clothing, and at this point, you know, God's not talking about Shangri-La after his return. He's talking about what happens before. By the way, you know, we talk a lot about the garden representing the epitome of what God intends and where we're going back. When you think about that, do you think that there were carnivores outside the garden?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Weren't they? Tyrannosaurus seems like pretty good. A lot of carnivores then. So I just don't see God being opposed to carnivores. All right, then I'll move on then to 11:7. We went through this before, but I'll just do it quickly. So the cow and the boar. Yeah, most places you read bear, but it could be boar or bear. And I think it's boar because he's talking about eating, and a boar will eat anything, and it's an unclean animal.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the cow and the boar will be shepherded together. Their youth will lie down. Now, this lie down is a bath again, will stretch out, or lie in wait, ready to pounce. The lion, if you're sick constructive, this is Arya, not the kefir, not the... the lion that represents Yehuda, and the lion will stalk its prey like the cattle, the bakar, large herds of animals, and they shall consume dry and brittle straw to them. We talked about this last week.
Mm-hmm.
You can't eat straw. You can eat it. You know, good luck with it. Was the Mad Hatter the old coach that was finally fired down there at LSU, man, he just loved to eat the grass.
Oh, yeah.
Grass will actually, human can't eat grass, and most animals can't eat grass and survive. But grass at least has some nutritional value. Straw's got none. None.
Put it on the bottom of the stalks, your horses.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it's good for,
yeah. That's all it's good for. This is not hay. Hay is fine, not for lions, but for cattle. But straw is not. What it means is that they're going to eat things that are not life-sustaining, is what is being conveyed there. And then this next line, to believe that God is going to say, is telling that after his return, that children are going to go put their hands down and play with snakes. I'm not buying that. So this is what I think it says. And the suckling infant will be blinded while playing over a pit of a venomous viper. And upon the illuminated nest, it's marura, the cavities in the ground where reptiles of a lesser light dwell. I thought it was really an interesting word, marura, because it's illuminated, it's light. It's not a bright light, but a lesser light. And so it's both the den in the ground of like a snake of a burrowing animal, but also conveys a lesser light. It's actually based upon the Hebrew word or. It's right in the middle of it. Yes. But it's ma in front of it, so it's what light? Do you understand the who, where, and why?
Yeah, we tell you that this morning. You ought to repeat that about why the M is so important.
Mm. Yeah, it's one of the things that I stumbled on when I was trying to translate Yeshaya 9:6. Yeshaya 9:6 has a ma Sarah in it twice, and just the Sarah of Sarah once, and the ma Sarah only appears in that one statement. Nowhere else. And the whole Torah prophet Psalms it appears twice. Both times are in the same statement. So I'm really well-versed on what Sarah represents. I mean, boy, have we ever studied Sarah. It means to endure, to exist, to be empowered, but also to wrestle and to strive and to struggle. That's why Yisrael is such a profound name. It could mean to struggle with God, to wrestle with God, have strife with God, but it also means to endure, engage and endure with God, as well as to be empowered by God when it's Yisrael. But when you put the Ma in front of it, it changes it, because it's just like Mikra. It's Kara, but with the Ma in front of it. And what Ma does is it encourages you to question and seek answers regarding the who, why, where, and how of the point being made. Shawa was the word we were covering today that came up in instruct. That Noach did everything that Yahweh instructed. It was Sawa, and it's mitzvah, the terms and conditions of the covenant, versus just teaching, when you put the ma in front of it. And what it means is you need to, and mikra is the same thing, understand the who, what, why, and where of this. You know, search for an answer so that you understand what follows. And so
that helped me a ton.
Yeah, understand the nature of this light would be ma or ra. It would be understand. Think about this the who, what, why, and where of this light. You know, when they were eating manna in the wilderness, and you know, Yahweh fed them the manna for the 40 years as they were wandering. You know what manna means? What is this? Where did this come from?
Yeah. Well, that's pretty good.
How are we giving
that's very
this?
Good, yeah.
Yeah, that's what it means.
Good.
And so, okay, you know, we see in the ma in front of a word, and it is in front of a lot of Hebrew words, where what it's in front of is well known, and you can look it up. The ma tells you to think about these things, to search for the answers to the who, what, why, and when, or how of that particular term.
It can't be real animals, and it has to be at what period of time? It cannot be post Yom Kippurim.
Right.
This has got to be.
Particularly when it's Sha'a, because Sha'a is equal parts play, having fun, and close their eyes, being blinded, lose their perception of sight. That's not amusing.
No.
Sorry. Over the pit of the venomous viper, Pethen is how we got the English word python.
Yeah.
The python's not venomous, but nonetheless, Pethen is a venomous viper, a poisonous snake. You know, I just love the root. You know, the root of the word, the verbal root of Pethen is to twist. You know, twist, corrupt. Yeah, it's just perfect to twist. Upon the illuminated nest. Now, as soon as you read illuminated nest, not just dens, but illuminated nest, now you're dealing with the brood of vipers. Now you're dealing with the snake of lesser light, of Satan.
That's the term,
of the deadly serpent, Tiffany. What's interesting here is this world is one of those that translators have a tough time with, because they want to make it sea serpents and dragons and everything else under the sun. But it's a deadly serpent. It's a lethal and toxic adder. It's from an unused root meaning to extrude. It's a mythical beast akin to a dragon. The winged and reared shall place their hand. I'm sorry. This is indicative of what people are doing prior to Yahweh's return. So then God says, but they shall not perpetrate evil, and they shall not corrupt anything in association with my set apart mouth, because the land shall be full of information which can be known about Yahweh, just as the waters are. adorn and cover the sea. Now, speaking of one of the many ways the world will come to know Yahweh, based upon what can be revealed and be fulfilled on that set-apart mountain, explaining how his children will one day understand what he has done on his set-apart mountain on their behalf. In the next statement, we're going to be reintroduced to the Neck Banner. And I say reintroduced, we first met the Neck Banner, encountered the Neck Banner, way back in the fifth chapter of Yeshayah, six chapters ago. And it was used there in a really inconspicuous way. Yeah, I was going to lift up a banner in the last days that would help people understand the nature, the importance of, and the value of the vineyard that he and Dod had built together. And then how man had come in to corrupt and uproot and to destroy the value of that vineyard. And so Yahweh says, I'm going to lift up a sign, a neck, that's going to explain what I was trying to do with Dod, why it was important, and how man went about corrupting it and destroying it. So,
okay,
you know, there's the neck.
Pardon? I was going to quote just a second, because that's where it has to be you, because no one is talking about Dod. Dod is David and Goliath's story. That's it, you know, or
yes.
All those troubles or what he did, you know, sometimes. Yes. Who on the planet is embracing the stories of Dod?
Yeah, and I want to be really clear on a point here, and I'm going to change a translation that we went forward. I'm going to change the word law on a translation because it's really important. I think the number of people that have either I have misspoken or they have not heard me accurately. I am not the neck. The neck is a sign. It's what's written that Yahweh lifts up. I'm becoming more.
You've written
and more
all about it.
That I said the neck is observations for our time, and to a lesser degree, an introduction to God, and yada yada, and questioning Paul, and even to a lesser degree, a prophet of doom. That
the translation
that explains what God is trying to convey to the world today. So the neck is what is being written, and a lot of us are contributing now to what's being written. I am not that. I am not the neck, and I've never claimed to be the neck. I'm not the neck. Yahweh and this prophecy that we're reading in Yeshayah 11 says that there's a choder, which is a really small, fairly inconspicuous stem on a secondary branch that is going to write the sign that Yahweh is going to lift up. It's hard for me to disassociate myself from the possibility that I'm the choder.
Mm-hmm.
But the neck is what's being written, and there's a number of us that are contributing to what's being written. So this is we are reintroduced to this. The last time we witnessed this banner, it was raised to confront the damage men had done to the vineyard Dod and Yahweh had cultivated on Moriah. The inference then was, as it is now, that Yahweh will lift up this ensign, this sign, this banner, prior to his return and for the express benefit of his people. And while there is still a connection with Dod, as there was way back in Yeshayah 5, this time we are told that the standard bearer will be an insignificant stem in and of himself. Yet, important only because his written message will be rooted in the relationship Yeshe's son and Yahweh, Yahweh's beloved, Dod, developed with the Almighty. Moreover, this time we're expressly told that this untrained sprout becomes worthy of notice, indeed serves God and his children as a trustworthy sign and reliable banner because of what the Spirit of Yahweh has done through him. So it's the Spirit of Yahweh that is communicating the information, conveying the information via understanding that and ability to make the connections that causes this thing to be written. Now, there is a huge difference between the Spirit speaking through a Nabi prophet, that's Yahweh speaking directly through a Nabi prophet, and the Spirit helping someone understand the word of Yahweh. They're very different concepts. Now, both could apply. With Dod, he had both. As for me, I only have one of those two. And that's really, I think, true with all of us. We have one of those two, not multiple of them. And by the way,
you can almost look at it as the difference between being inspired by the Spirit and the Spirit inspiring you.
Right. You know, and one of the reasons, too, and this is why it's so important to talk about this, one of the reasons that I finally relented and said, JB, you came to the same conclusion, that one of the reasons that I stopped fighting the idea of being the choder, this untrained tendril or stem that's grafted into a secondary branch that's grafted into the main branches of the tree that is the tree of lives in the garden, is that the time required to do what needs to be to learn and understand and then compose what is on this sign. You're looking at 15 years. We don't have 15 years.
No.
So there is
well, someone's been doing this and has been completely and utterly silent this entire time and is just all of a sudden going to come out with some huge, great thing.
Correct. Now, the only way that somebody
how you could be learning that and not sharing it, I don't get.
So the only way that you can get around the time is for the person who writes this sign to be a Navi. I don't think there are any Navis today.
Well, if there was,
he would have said Navi.
He would have said Navi. He did. He said stick. Stick is an implement. He didn't say Navi. That's what finally caused me to say, all right, I'm comfortable being a stick. I am not a Navi prophet. Do not want to be a Navi. I understand it's the highest calling you could have, but I don't want that responsibility. Goodness gracious.
If y'all were asked me to, I'd do it, but I don't want that.
Oh, I'd beg.
I'd be motioning going, no, say, not me.
No, not me. Cause, you know, how many opportunities do you have to be wrong as a Navi and survive it?
None. Zero.
No, I don't want to do that. Okay. Now, I personally doubt that the standard bearer will be a direct descendant of Yahshua's father because there would be no way for him to know it or prove it today. None. Why would you give information that can't be known or proved? Now, based upon this discussion and people saying, well, then you probably should do a DNA test. And I've done a DNA test. I sent it in, 6 weeks from now, I'll know. But the best they're going to do, the best they could do is say, with your heritage traces back through this group of people or that group of people, there is a 0% chance they could say, oh, yeah, you're a direct descendant of those. None. Can't be done. So, no, I don't think that's what's being conveyed here because God would never get it. There is no reason for Yahweh to offer a prophecy that can't be proven. And this one can't be proven. So I don't think he is a DNA direct descendant of Yishai, Dod's father. That just is not the case. And it doesn't mean that. The words that are chosen here are chosen such that you're grafted into the tree of life. That's what it's conveying. And the trunk of the tree the tree of life is now rooted in Yisrael, and the tree itself, the main trunk is Yahweh and his Torah, and the two branches that come out of it are Dod and Yahusha. Those are the two main branches. And then there's a lot of secondary branches. Netzers are secondary branches. And then, there's a lot of us that are just choders or little stems that are grafted onto those secondary branches. There's a lot of us choders out there.
So what I find interesting is that, that word grafted is the word used so often to speak of Goyim who become part of Israel.
Grafted onto the tree.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And by the way, the first time that neck was used, it was a long way away in a far distant time, so that the person writing the neck was doing so a very long way away from Israel at a very distant time.
Which may be in the middle of the United States?
Yeah. And I don't know what the DNA test is going to say, but I sort of like the idea. And this was Lisa that came up with this idea, and I sort of like it. The idea that Yahweh chose Israel. Now, if you were a Nabi, you'd have to be Israel or Yehuda. But he chose them. He's re-choosing them is something he's making abundantly clear as we move forward. But offers them everything, and they turned up their nose at him and thumbed their nose at him. It's kind of poetic. Just to some idiot out there, all this time later, would stumble on their testimony in their language and figure out what they've missed and say, hey, you guys, this is for you. Pay attention. It just seems to me to be, it would be so Yahweh to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that would be fitting in terms of having a, like I said, not having a Nabi, but, choosing a Shoder.
Right.
Basically being like, I could not find a prophet amongst you. I had to go to a Goyim to find someone to do this.
Right, to do this. And I had to have the Spirit work double time to help him figure all this stuff out. And I had to have an old retired guy. Because of the amount of time that was required to do it. Now, let's say this guy really slow.
Dagon, he wore me out.
Okay, people. Now, there you go.
Well, the trouble with choosing somebody in his family is most of them are so overwhelmed by the community. I mean, how do you... Boy, he would really be criticized the minute he starts doing this. If he was a Yehudim in New York or something like that, and he caught up with this and published this, my gosh, they would be marching in the streets around him.
Let me ask you a question there, Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
The three different groups that that I've disassociated with and we parted company with,
that's
really nice thing. Are they saying really nice things about me?
I take that back. I'm sorry. You're incorrect. They ain't been pleasant, is it?
No.
Okay. Never mind.
No.
I had a senior moment there. So.
Nobody that has ever worked with Yahweh in any capacity is popular. It's a really unpopular. If you're popular, you're doing it wrong. Let me just say, if they love you, you are really doing it wrong.
You got the wrong translation. Go retranslate.
So anyway, if it was a DNA descendant, the prophecy is irrelevant because it can't be shown, can't be proven, and I don't think Yahweh issues prophecies that can't be proven.
There'd be no point to it.
If Yahweh is predicting that his nameless envoy, an ensign, will base his message upon the foundation which was laid by Dodd, drawing the world's attention to it, then all one need to do to validate the sign would be to study what was written on it. Forget about the individual. What's written there?
Yeah.
Is it valid?
Well, what did he say?
Just
then.
Right. If it contains a responsible, reasonable, and rational presentation of what Dodd had to say about engaging in relationship with God, the banner is worth considering. Why? Because it examines what Dodd had to say.
Mm-hmm.
And what Yahweh had to say about Dodd. So long as the witness is rooted in what can be excavated and mined from the source, discovering by digging deep into the Mizmor, the Psalms of Dodd and Mashal, which I believe that Dodd wrote almost all of, if not all of, you can validate it. It is in this way, and only in this manner, that the banner will remain firmly anchored, rooted, permanently positioned, and appropriately instructive, providing reliable and godly guidance. Further, since the scribe composing the sign isn't named, determining his identity is a stick versus a branch when compared to addressing the validity of the message. It goes right back to the introduction of every book. Hello, call me Yada. I'm irrelevant. Now, let's talk about what is relevant. And that, my friends, is the only reason Yahweh continues to depict and describe this neck sign. In a world full of lies, with men accustomed to deceit, it is the best way to convince his children that they can trust and rely upon what is written thereon because he contributed to the content and is responsible for bringing it to their attention. He's the one promoting it. The Spirit is the one that provided the understanding that made it possible. Now, for those who would protest and appeal such conclusions, I'm right there with you. The predictions presented in Yahshua 11 are profoundly important, and no one in their right mind would want to live up to such expectations. I certainly don't want that kind of responsibility. Such a claim would and has and will draw ferocious criticism. For these reasons and more, I completed this review of Yahshua, Isaiah 11, without any mention of observations for our time, possibly serving as a sign, possibly representing what might grow out of the stump of Yahshua, of potentially being enlightened and empowered by the Spirit. Not a peep. Now, this is notably different than my response when we first encountered this neck banner. Way back in chapter 15 of rejecting Yahweh's Torah, as it was called, as it sought to understand the prophecy in Yahshua, Isaiah 5:26. It was there that we read, "Then he will lift up a standard, serving as a banner and signal for the Gentile nations from far away, from afar, great distance away in the distant future. And he will attract attention non-verbally. He will reveal the signal by drawing attention to it from the ends of the earth. And behold, in a very brief period of time, quickly, rapidly, voiced at the speed of light, it will come." I had no problem with that. That sounded like, you know, one of those things that... Wow, it's like tailor-made for what we're doing, as you said. Who else is talking about the vineyard that Dode and Yahweh built together and why it's just so destructive that man has criticized it, particularly in conjunction with the Torah? And so, you know, that's pretty cool. Wow, you know, you got a gold star from teacher. You know, that was for me, it looked like it was a completely anonymous... Attaboy. Kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
However, that is not the nature of this prophecy. You know, this prophecy, the whole Christian world speaks of, you know, of Yahusha.
Jesus.
They're Jesus. No, I don't want to be. In fact, the entire chapter is devoted to this silly old stick. And the sign that the stick is prepared to write based upon the Spirit's contribution. And then of Yahweh lifting it up. And the reasons and the timing that he lifts it up. No, that's not what you want. That's way too, puts a person in a very vulnerable position.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the passage. "And it shall come to pass. It will happen." Now, when God says it's going to happen, it's going to happen. In that day. When he speaks of in that day, what day? What day is he even talking about?
Kippur.
Yeah, upon his return, and much of it just prior to his return. "That the root, the foundation and root of the matter, that which is excavated and mined from the source by those who dig deep, and that which keeps one firmly anchored, permanently positioned and properly nourished and thus informed of Yahshua to stand out and be noticed on behalf of the source of existence." Yish means to exist and to become substantial, to stand up and be noticed, to draw attention and to be enriched as a reward. And Yahweh doesn't mean monetarily. So, "and it shall come to pass in that day, the root of Yishe, who to show the way will stand up and present himself. Concerning, and this is the word that I changed, that's law. I had as a signal and banner, I think is probably more correct in this case to say concerning a signal and banner for God's family. So here, the purpose of the signal and banner is for God's family. God's family would be comprised of two different groups. The first group is Yisrael. The second group is those who are grafted into Yisrael, who are Goyim members of the covenant. So God's family is the covenant, but his family is also Yisrael, who are most of whom are not part of the covenant at this point. But the signal and banner is for God's family. Am El. That's really important. That's one of the reasons why I was so frustrated with people who were promoting conspiracy theories or just saying all sorts of things that were so slanderous and demeaning while using transliterations that are only known through this research. Mm-hmm. Conclusions that have only been presented through these books and these programs. Names and translations that are only part of these. And I say, you know, when you do that kind of thing, you're undermining the principal purpose of this, which is to awaken and teach Yahweh's chosen people. Am El, God's family. Please don't do that. So, this says that has two words that are made powerfully important from my point of view prior to Neck, and one is Asher. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm here because of Asher. One for Asher. Asher is one of my very favorite words. You know, you could just say who and leave it alone, but Asher means to show the way, to reveal the correct path to walk, to give meaning to life, to receive the benefits of the relationship. Asher is a really, really powerful word. And based on Asher, I know I have, and now many of us have, taken a stand. Mm-hmm. We've presented ourselves. We have present the means to evaluate the one who appointed and sustains us. We're providing the means to evaluate the evidence and make a thoughtful decision, standing steadfastly, attending to this stance, continually persisting and enduring. And then I think concerning is probably a better rendition of law in this case, as opposed to has, a signal and banner, the neck. They sign an ensign, something which is lifted up to communicate a message for those who are observant, from naka, to assess and to prove, to examine, analyze, and evaluate, and to test, and nakak, to lift up and display, and naka, to set forth on a journey for God's family. Through him, Gentiles will seek. Well, I know some Gentiles that have sought because of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking to two of them.
Right here?
Yes, sir. Yes.
That would be the purpose. I mean, it wasn't the primary purpose of waking God's children. But in the short term, the thing that has been the most prevalent is Goyim, Gentiles, using what was written to seek, inquire about, investigate, search for, expecting to find a responsible presentation about engaging in a relationship with Yahweh that was nourishing and keeps them safe. That's what Daresh means. And so, therefore, his restful residence, it's not my restful residence. My residence today was not restful at all. I had my little granddaughter here all day. She is a delight. It was totally fun, but it was not restful. And so, therefore, his restful residence, that's Yahweh's restful residence, his place of repose and reflection, his comfortable habitation from Nuach, spiritual contentment, and Nawa, living in a spiritual dwelling and abode where sheep abide, will exist as a glorious reward, existing as a source of enrichment and empowerment. Now, the reason that that happens to be important is that the Gentiles who are going to seek are going to find Yahweh's home. And their reward's going to be to live in that home as part of a marvelous and enjoyable relationship. So it's a source of enrichment and empowerment. Kabood, what a wonderful
deal.
Yeah, term, you know. Haya, Kabood, Haya. Was, mm-hmm. is, and will always be valuable, honorable, dignified as a gift, always existing as a place of significant abundance and as a manifestation of tremendous power. That is what we're receiving as part of the covenant. Now, that's a lot to process, so that's probably a good thing to linger here a moment. The Sheresh, the root of Yishay, can convey a number of things, all of which are pertinent. And the connotation is worth considering because Sherith cannot be interpreted literally and must be interpreted as a metaphor. Yishay did not have roots. He had feet.
Yeah.
So did not have roots. He had feet.
Yeah.
When you're speaking of roots, it is a metaphor.
Yes.
Therefore, for somebody that's hung up and said, well, that means you have to be a direct descendant. No. That would be from sperm and eggs, and therefore DNA, not roots. Root, folks, root is a metaphor.
Yes.
You know, smile. embrace the fact that not everything can be interpreted literally. Root is a symbol. Sheresh could imply that the standard bearer will be a direct descendant of Yishay. That's a possibility, and thus a Yehud in the line of Dod. But if so, there would be no way to prove it or to know it. It could convey that he will get right to the root of the matter, and that Dod's life and words will serve as the foundation of his message. Of particular interest, Sheresh implies that the ensign will dig deep and mine the depths of what can be learned from Dod and Yosha. Doing so will assure that he and his message, Sheresh, remain firmly anchored and permanently positioned while being appropriately nourishing, which is to say the message promotes growth and it's enduring in addition to being reliable. I think Sheresh is a marvelous term to convey all of those things.
Well, you know, I found that it says, like, to deal with the roots, to take the roots in the soil, or to take out of the soil, or to dig deep. So from the standpoint, if we're talking about metaphors, and you're digging in this wealth of material, trying to find the truth, trying to find the covenant family, how to get there, it's most appropriate. I mean, it's a great word.
It really is. So many connotations of that metaphor that serve to convey what is going on here. Now, since we know almost nothing about Yishay, the message cannot be about him, but instead must focus on what we know of his son, Dod, Yahweh's beloved son. And yet, from Yishay's name, we can deduce that Yahweh's banner will stand out and be noticed, and that the message will be substantial rather than brief, and that it will speak of the source of our existence and draw attention to the process of being enriched. In other words, it's going to be dissimilar to everything else that has been written by people, and yet be wholly consistent with Yahweh's Torah, guidance, and Navi prophets, especially with Dod's Mizmor Psalms. Now, I've mentioned this before, but I have a particular fascination with Asher. It's the word which brought me out of Christianity and from a reliance on religious translations to Yahweh by studying Hebrew. And a particular interest in this context, the first time I encountered Asher was in relation to a prophecy regarding a descendant of Dod. And here it is again. Subsequently, I've devoted my life to knowing Yahweh and understanding his word and then sharing what I've discovered as openly and completely as possible. Asher is a relational term, and thus one of many describing the covenant, which is a relationship agreement. Asher is used to make connections, to associate things which belong together, and thus serves as a catalyst between knowing and understanding. Especially important, Asher speaks of showing the way, of revealing the correct path to walk, to give meaning to life, and to receive the benefits associated with the covenant relationship. It is the way to heaven's door. Asher describes a specific, certain, narrow, and restrictive path. a lot of people talk about the way of God, you know, that sort of thing. I don't know, apart from our group, of anybody describing the Moed Mikre as the path that gives life meaning, as they, you know, there are the holy convocations of Israel, you know, their Jewish holidays. Who is talking about the Moed Mikre as a path besides us?
Yes. Signpost along the way, too.
It's a way to give life meaning. A path that is narrow and restrictive. I don't think anybody else is.
Well, the minute you walk away from the other and you walk down these, you ain't going to be walking with a lot of people.
No, you aren't. they will separate
the Christmas party
is across
the street. They don't want to go to our house, so there you have it. Yeah.
Now, Ahmad addresses one of the most startling and controversial concepts associated with God. He wants us to stand up and not bow down. He's always looking for someone to take a stand on what really matters in life, recognizing that doing so will be astonishingly unpopular. But what we don't typically think of when addressing Ahmad is that it suggests that the individual who is drawing attention, or the individual who is taking, I should say, the stand on behalf of the relationship between Yahweh and Dod, would be appointed and sustained by God, and that his mission would be to provide the means to evaluate the evidence. That's something I know that Yahweh introduced himself and he gave me a mission initially, and we engaged on that mission, and it was obvious that we were working together through that first mission, and then we started a second mission, and the insights were so unique and so profound and so uncommon throughout the human experience that it was pretty clear that we were working together on this mission as well. I never, ever thought of myself as being appointed and sustained. I want to be careful here, too. I mean, I knew I took a stand. That was pretty obvious. Because there wasn't anybody else saying this stuff.
No.
But appointed and sustained is a, by God, is a, says, you know, there's a mission and I want it done. Well, I knew I was appointed and sustained to do the mission of Prophet Bill. I would never say it in those words, but that was clear. And it's just that when you talk about his word and explain it to people in a modern setting, you just think of that as, you know, you're part of the covenant family, you're learning things. By God, you want to share it.
Mm-hmm.
What's more important than letting people know how marvelous this story is, how magnanimous the offer is, how wrong the world has been? You don't think you'd have to be appointed and sustained simply to reveal the most important truth in the world.
No. I ran out and told all my students this story and ran a bunch of them off.
Yeah.
I was really excited to show it to them, and they were really excited to hear it, though.
Yeah.
But, that's the way it goes. So.
And Ahmad also means that it conveys the means to evaluate the evidence that our Heavenly Father has provided in a way that enables the open and honest individual to make a thoughtful decision. Ahmad fits like a perfectly formed glove. It's a marvelous term. Now, this brings us to the next, the standard bearer, the signal and banner, the ensign which is lifted up to communicate the message to those who are observing. And that it is based on Na'ak. We know that as a result of the message, those who observe it will be able to assess its content and prove its veracity. It will be written in such a way that it promotes further examination and an ongoing analysis. Boy, have you guys ever caught that? You guys are both deep into that. That it's encouraging people to investigate further. That your first inclination is to validate whether or not what's being said is true. But your second is, wow, I enjoyed that.
What else is there?
What else is there? Let's go further. Right?
Yes, I almost missed the show today because I sat down to start translating at 3 o'clock, and I only happened to get up about 3 minutes before the show began to use the restroom, and I looked at the clock and went, oh, no.
That's how it goes. Engrossed. I got it.
It is intoxicating a little bit. It's just,
it happens to It happens to all of us. I've come very close many, many times for the exact same reason. You get really engrossed in it. It's marvelous stuff. So readers will be encouraged to evaluate and test everything that's presented. So whether or not it's lived up to the standard, Observation for a Time was written to accomplish these very goals. We can also affirm via Naak, that the banner will be lifted up and displayed and thus promoted by God himself. Further, Naka implies that it will be the product of a journey of discovery, one of my favorite terms, this coin of voyage of discovery, suggesting that it will map out the course the explorer charted as he made his way through God's word. Now, for those of you who may wonder why Yahweh would work with a flawed implement, untrained pendroller stick, to reach his children and not just speak to them himself, well, I would encourage you to read Shemoth Exodus, beginning with Yahweh introducing himself to Moshe, up to the point that God agrees not to speak directly to his children again because they were growing fearful of hearing his booming voice. It is what it is, folks.
Yeah.
I understand. I appreciate why Yahweh chooses to communicate and teach people through, broken down tools. I understand that. I get it, why he wants to do that. And I know a lot of people don't. I guess you really got to become comfortable with Yahweh to know that that's just his style. And it's not just that he isn't braggadocious. He's not flashy. The booming voice and the fire at the top of the mountain. He said, I'm not going to do that for you anymore. That was too in your face, too bold, too flashy for the Israelites. They hated it. God said, I'm just not going to do that anymore. That's part of it. What was the purpose of creating mankind in the first place?
To interact.
Right. Yeah. And if he's going to interact with man, what kind of men and women are there?
Well, he came to create them.
Right. So the only kind of people he can work with.
Mm-hmm. Oh, flawed. Yes,
right?
Indeed.
Yeah. But isn't that the whole idea of bad? Yeah. Bad is trying to make us less flawed? More empowered.
Yeah, Christianity's got all the scholars anyway.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly.
You don't need those. They got plenty.
Yeah, exactly.
Choose from the other pool.
Yeah. So it's the more you study it, it becomes comforting. Now, this was a really interesting point. He says, then, so he raises the banner. Then what happens? Then it shall come to pass in that day. My upright one will once again, this is now Yeshaya speaking on behalf of Yahweh, will once again join his hand a second time to bring forth and redeem his family, which remains, and they're going to redeem them out of Asher, from Mitzrayim, out of Pathrok, which is subject to deception and interpretation, likely the upper Egypt. From Cush, which is dark and unknown, up northern Mesopotamia is where Cush is. It's not Ethiopia. Out of Elam, which is means to conceal, that's Persia. From Shinar, which is a confluence of two rivers, Babylonia. There is no Babylonia anymore. He's not pulling them from Sumer or Babylonia. It's what those things represent. And out of Shamath, military fortress Syria, and from the coastlands. If it wasn't for that last one, you'd have that's how many Israelites there probably are, and all those places previously mentioned. Those places previously mentioned were mentioned because they represent something about the past history of Yahweh's people and their propensity to accept the ways of those Gentile nations, and what transpired in those countries, how Asher and Shinar and Babylonia, if you will, and Mitzrayim enslaved and abused his children. So I'm going to remove them from that, is what that says. Where they're coming from, is E, the coastlands. The shores of countries between are surrounded to some extent by large bodies of water. Now, that would notably be the United States, Canada, Central and South America, Western, Northern, and Southern Europe, Turkey, India, New Zealand, Australia, and South Africa. And this is the coastlands of the sea. From the shores of countries between or surrounded to some extent by large bodies of water of the sea. Now, it should be noted that while E, Ha, Ya, the coastlands of the sea, that should be E, Ha, Yam. Make a little correction here to get that typo out of the way. Descriptive of any Gentile nation with extensive ocean shoreline. E also means woe, telling us that conditions within these nations will continue to deteriorate, necessitating a warning of dire consequence for the children of Israel, especially those who intend to stay. They need to know. They need to listen. Underscoring this cautionary notice, ye is also the howl of a vicious and cunning beast. If you're listening, you've heard this agonizing wail, having just witnessed the world's reaction to President Trump's announcement that Jerusalem was the capital of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Trump also is holding up the payment of $125 million in aid to the mythical people known as the Palestinians. And they their response is, we will not be blackmailed. Think about that. How stupid do you have to be to, A, say that, and B, write it, and not say, how can you be blackmailed based upon stopping a gift?
Yeah.
You know, if you're extorting money and it says, listen, or I'm extorting you in some way, I'm going to take your children unless you comply, that would be blackmail. I've stolen your money, and unless you you comply, you're not getting your money back. That would be blackmail.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not going to give you
interrupting a gift ain't blackmail. So
yeah.
For them to protest and use those words shows just how stupid Muslims have become. And for a journalist to write them and not say, wait a minute, you know, providing charity and interrupting the flow of charity is never blackmail. Now, while the Jewish population still living in diaspora has declined from 10.5 to 8 million since 1948, there are still between 5.7 and 6.7 million Jews in the United States, 95% of whom live within 20 miles of the coast, along either the Atlantic Ocean, Gulf of Mexico, or the Pacific Ocean. Of the most recent migration of Jews to Israel, many have come of their own volition from the two most prominent areas not already covered in this new list, the Russian Federation, which would be all of Russia excluding St. Petersburg,
mm-hmm.
and from the southern portion of the old USSR, especially the northern Ukraine, and from the Caucasus region, where there are essentially no Jews left. So the places that he did not mention from the coastlands of the sea, the Jews have already migrated to Israel.
Yeah.
Other than Israel, only the United States, Canada, and Australia have seen a growth in their Israelite populations. The Jewish residents in Eastern Europe, Northwestern Africa, and most of the Muslim world have all but disappeared. So the following is a list of nations replete with their Israelite population, and it has been provided so that we might calculate how many Jews will be included in Yahweh's repatriation and how that compares to the entire Jewish population. I was curious, you know, if you're going to list these particular places and you're going to say, and from the Gentile nations of the sea that are from their coastline lands, how many people that represent? Well, 6.2 million in the United States. 6,200,000, plus or minus 500,000. And that's increasing significantly. France, 450,000, declining rapidly. Canada, 385,000. It's increasing significantly. The United Kingdom, 260,000. That's declining. Russia, very little Russia other than Leningrad, which is not Leningrad anymore. It's St. Petersburg. And it's a very artistic, very sophisticated city. So you probably have more Jews in St. Petersburg, and also Crimea would also qualify. So St. Petersburg and Crimea would qualify. I can't tell you how many of the 180,000 there, so we'll just say that some. Argentina would absolutely qualify, 175,000. Germany, most of Germany would not qualify, with exception of the Baltic coast. There's 93, and look how this has fallen off. 6.2 million, 450,000, 485,000, 260, 180, 175, 95. There's 115,000, increasing insignificantly, and Australia qualifies. Brazil is 95,000, it qualifies. South Africa, 70,000, it qualifies. There are 60,000 that remain in Ukraine, declining rapidly, and with the exception of the Black Sea coast, none of those would qualify. And so I put the Ukraine as... the few Jews that are there, they're on their own. They better figure it out and figure it out in a hurry. But the Ukraine is getting stunningly nasty. Hungary, 45,000. Boy, there's a lot of riots right now in Hungary against Jews. Mexico, 45,000. That would qualify. Spain, 30,000 qualifies. Belgium, 30,000 qualifies. Netherlands, 30,000 qualifies. Italy, 30,000 qualifies. Switzerland does not qualify, 19,000. Chile qualifies, 19,000. Turkey qualifies, declining rapidly, by the way, 17,000. Sweden, 15,000 qualifies. Uruguay, 12,000 qualifies. Not Paraguay, Uruguay. Belarus, 11,000 does not qualify. Panama, 10,000 qualifies. Romania, 9,000 does not qualify. Austria, not Australia, but Austria, 9,000 does not qualify. Iran was actually listed in the preceding list. There's 9,000. Azerbaijan, it was included in that list that Yahweh provided, that northern part north of Mesopotamia. Mm-hmm. That would be Kush, for example, that qualifies. Poland does not qualify, landlocked, 7,000. Venezuela qualifies, 8,000. New Zealand qualifies, 7,000. Denmark qualifies, 6,000. Morocco qualifies, 6,000. Latvia qualifies, 6,000. Hong Kong qualifies, 5,000. India qualifies, 5,000. Greece qualifies, 4,000. Colombia qualifies, 4,000. All other countries that would be included as Gentile countries with considerable coastlands along the sea, 43,000 qualify. All other excluded countries, 15,000 disqualified. Now, hard to process all that verbally, but completely included is 8,285,000. 8,285,000 rescued. Partially included, 275,000 are partially included. So let's just say that maybe 175 of that group. Mostly excluded, 60,000. Let's say that 10,000 are included out of that 60. That's like, you know, St. Petersburg and Crimea and Russia. Completely excluded, 265,000 not rescued. Now, this means that 97% of the Israelite population in diaspora will be rescued by Yahweh based upon the list he has provided, or at the very least, given the opportunity to come back home should they accept his offer. Even if 80% of the Jewish population chooses to remain in the places now run amok in the rising tide of anti-Semitism, such as Poland, Austria, Romania, Belarus, Hungary, the Ukraine, Russia, God is offering sanctuary in Israel to 99% of his people. This does not mean that Israel will be safe, far from it, as it will continue to endure the indignity of Islam. But the Jews will fare far better there than any other place on earth. Some will even come to see the return of Yahweh there. So it's 99% when you take the time to look at how many Jews live in nations that either qualify or that do not qualify. Now, I thought it might be just interesting to look at some of the places that where there are very few Jews. You know, just in case you were curious along with me, Islam is so inhospitable. According to the CIA's database, there are 18 Jews in all of Egypt, 100 in Pakistan, 30 in Yemen, fewer than 10 in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, Kuwait, Libya, Algeria, Sudan, Somalia, Bangladesh, Afghanistan, Malaysia, and Indonesia. That's fewer than 250 Jews among 1,100,000,000 Muslims. That's 0.8
in places like Saudi Arabia. How are they hiding out pretty good?
Well, no. I didn't say, well, what I said was, I didn't say there was 10. I said there was less than 10.
Yeah.
The CIA's database goes down to 10. If it's less than 10, they report no number. So it could be zero. So rather than 0.0002%, it could be 0.00002%. But isn't that amazing? Now,
well, I was noticing on the ones that are declining, like in France and United Kingdom and so forth, and Germany, significant declining. They all seem to be heavily, heavily involved with the migration of Muslims to those countries. You know, when like the Ukraine, it didn't like it. And it's just amazing.
Exactly.
There's getting to be nowhere to hide here. Go to Yellow.
Yeah. So, you know, the Muslims always say, oh, we're so accommodating of Jews. Look how more accommodating we were than the Roman Catholic Church. Well, 0.00002%.
And that's big wealth, doesn't it?
Yeah. China's not so good either. There are 2,500 residing in China. It's a nation of 1.4 billion. That's not much of a percentage.
No.
If you're a Gentile, God is going to give you one last opportunity to walk away from your country and engage in his covenant with Israel. But if you are a Christian, goodbye, good riddance. You will not be among those God will be bringing home. This is yet another death knell in the coffin of replacement theology. Yahweh is specifically bringing 99% of Israelites home to Israel before he returns. And he's using this neck sign to assist in that, to get their attention in that regard. Sorry. No church.
Of the Yehudi that you know now, does it come up in conversation at all? I mean, I know a lot of Jewish people and their friends and students and friends and long-term friends and occur there. It's not like they or their children are thinking or grandchildren are thinking about moving to Israel. Is it going on them?
You know what's interesting? Not only do we have a number of people who knew they were Israelite when they came into the government, like the first person that read yada yada that responded in favor and decided to form a relationship with Yahweh was Dr. Jim Brill. He's Jewish. So it began there. The second was the guy that posts all these sites, my friend Joe Page, and he also is Jewish. and there's many others. But what's interesting is that I've received now maybe a dozen letters from people based upon this Choder thing and from the stem of Yishai and that sort of thing. That, you know, just out of curiosity, they did a DNA test. And every single one of them that told me they took a DNA test came back as Jewish.
Didn't
think they were. Yeah. Yep. So, that's sort of interesting, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought so. It got my attention when I read those letters. Not what I expected. Now, I think let's just read this next passage. We're recording but not broadcasting, and you can see I'm still dealing with the cough associated with that flu that I had now 3 weeks ago.
You definitely sound a lot better, though.
Oh, I feel a lot better. I feel 100%. I don't have any issues other than the cough snagging. It's, you know, that when you have one of those things, your sinuses continue to drip down your back of your throat, and it's irritated, or you try to cough it up. And it's just irritating. Not irritating pain. It's irritating in the sense that I'm coughing too much. I apologize for that. It says, so he will lift up. This is now after telling him, I'm going to get my children, get their attention through this sign. So he says, and he will lift up a neck, the signal and banner for the Gentiles and their nations. Now, why would he say that after having to pull his family from those nations?
And it's nothing. He's always fair.
Always fair, man.
I told you.
Don't interfere.
Yeah.
It's a really bad idea to oppose God. It's not a good idea to reject God or just be neutral, you know, to be religious and squander the opportunity. That's not a good choice. But it's a really bad choice to oppose him, to get in his way.
It's kind of more of a neutral choice.
Yeah, so I came to the same conclusion. The reason he's lifting up the signal and banner in this context for the Gentile nations and their nations is, don't get in the way. Don't interfere. The consequences of you interfering with this are going to be grievous. You go from ceasing to exist to spending your eternity in Sheol. Fair warning. Powerful, I think.
Yeah.
Then, as you say, God's always fair. Then he will gather together and remove the scattered of Yisrael. And the dispersed of Yahudah he will gather up and obtain from the four extremities of the earth. So, sign lifted up. Here's where the people are coming from. Sign lifted up. This is what I'm going to do. By the way, with that last statement there, from the four extremities of the earth, four corners of the earth, the distant places of the earth, now it goes from 99 to 100%.
Yeah.
All right.
Did you know, I read one time, if you took a line, north-south line through Israel, and you did the same thing going east-west, that the four corners, the four sections that you carve out of the globe have equal amount of mass, land mass on every corner? Maybe it has nothing to do with anything.
But I think if you were to take two intersecting lines, well, I guess not. No, because you would have... No, I guess not. Yeah, I was saying that no matter where you're
going. Some guy
had no. You know, you'd
all
have
the
to.
Stuff. No, and I thought, well, that's really amazing that it comes right through Israel. Years ago, I read that. So
yeah,
I was thinking about that when I read.
The north-south line is irrelevant. Any north-south line through any point cuts the world in half. Right?
Yeah.
Any north-south line that goes directly north and south. Not magnetic, but the geo-north-south is going to cut the world in half. So then to have four equal mass quadrants, the east-west line has to be on the equator.
Okay.
The further north it goes, it would exclude, they would not be of equal mass as the ones to the south. So whoever did that that particular...
wrong, okay.
Yeah, the wrong, because the equator is more south.
Give me when I was reading this, four extremities.
Yeah, the north-south line is irrelevant, and the east-west line would not be equal.
Okay, we'll throw that one away.
Yeah, I'll throw that one away. And it can't even be an equal number of people, because even though there's smaller land mass on the...
Oh, no, I know. I wasn't talking about the people. It's just,
there'd be a lot more people than in the larger land masses on the south. So... That gets us to 11, 12. We'll return to that next week. I think that's a good spot for us to take a break, and we'll finish up with the program. We'll continue with the story of Babel and the Bible and being with the Lord and on observations, and we'll pick up from this next week that way.
Okay.
The cough hopefully will be a lot better next week. I won't continue to aggravate it by this. And, you know, no challenge this week other than, you know, where we're going to start and finish. And I was actually hoping, Kirk, that you were going to find that my analysis of the animal ball playing nice together was wrong, and that they were, there was that possibility. But
Well, I got about half of it done, and I couldn't find anything, and I ran out of time. But and I didn't explain it very well. But I mean, on my notes, but it's just no way.
Well, I think the point you made about they've actual wolf.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that alone is telling. If this is the only time it is ever translated that way, anytime I come across a book like that where it's in one place it's translated this way and nowhere else, never have I come to the conclusion that translation was right. Every time like that, the other translation, the way it's used every other time, makes much more sense here than this translation.
Right. For example, when Yahweh said that Benjamin shall be the wolf, does he think he was saying that Benjamin is going to be an actual wolf?
No.
I had a guy in the forum one time who was convinced that every part of the Torah was 100% literal.
No.
And he refused to acknowledge that was not literal.
No. No.
Well, even in Ezekiel, when he's talking about the...
We're talking about the roots of Yeshay? Root is a metaphor. Yeshay did not have roots.
Yes.
And they talk about the stump.
Not a tree. Nobody's stuck in a tree.
Was not a stump. I'm sorry. It's a metaphor.
Yeah.
You know, the tree of life is symbolic. The trees of life, the tree of lives, it's symbolic. The tree of the knowledge of it's symbolic. These things are, you know, word pictures, folks.
Yeah.
Word pictures. That's how we understand. That's how we visualize things. You know, as an artist, you have a huge advantage over us. You know, a lot of times the process of coming from knowing to understanding is being able to visualize things.
Mm-hmm.
So, Yahweh is a very visual communicator.
Right.
Yeah. Whoever thinks every word is literal, I mean, you're just, come on.
Yeah.
Like, if, for example, it talks of uses these terms of 1 year in speaking of the various animals for sacrifice. Now I know even Turks have talked about them being perfect. But what does this thing isn't perfect?
No.
And, you know,
it was declared perfect. The best they could come up with. This is our best one. That's the best you could do. Yeah.
Right. Take a perfect lamb from your flock. Well, what if I didn't have any perfect lambs this year? Every one of my lambs came out with spots. I can't control that.
Yeah.
You know, I have a rack of land every Pesach. I do not go to the butcher and say, did this come from a perfect lamb?
I go to Costco. I find the best-looking leg of lamb they have in their selection. I take it home. I marinate it, and I cook it over fire.
Why was the lamb called perfect? Because the only way that the Passover lamb could accept our faults and not go to Sheol on based upon his own faults is for the Pesach lamb to have been perfect. Yeah. Does that mean that everything that Yosha did in his life was perfect? No. But it means that he was right with Yahweh, and from the time the Spirit came upon him, he didn't violate the Torah.
I don't want to keep you from going, but let me ask you the question again because I don't want to mislead or say anything wrong about Yosha.
Yeah.
Is his soul like a normal soul? When she got pregnant and there's a baby there, it has a soul. Is that Yahweh's soul? Did he deliver his particular soul, or did he create that? Or he just claimed it as his soul? Or?
Yes and no. And I'm sorry for the yes and no. Say Yahweh's soul, and from our perspective, Kirk, without your soul, you're nothing.
I know.
You're nothing.
I'm an animal at best.
Right.
Now,
well,
I can't even live without
all
soul.
All animals have soul. You take the soul from an animal.
Yeah, I can't
even
live.
It's nothing but dead and decomposed.
It's dead.
Yahweh did not die when he offered his soul. Mm-hmm. Our soul is the essence of who we are. Our proclivities, our personalities, our experiences, our memories. Mm-hmm. Our soul is the essence of who we are. Yahweh has a soul very much like he has other implements and tools. His soul is not germane to him. It's not essential to him. So we have to
be
that. So that's what I mean. Is it a soul that Yahweh personally inserted into the fetus of that Mary was carrying? Absolutely. Yeah, and I think that and I think it was Roy that came up with the design. I think it was a good idea that was the job of Gabriel.
The spirit.
Yeah, Gabriel.
Yeah.
He was conveying that soul, but you have to be careful in that Yahweh is not an animal with a soul that is the essence of the life of that animal.
Mm-hmm.
He has a soul. He had a soul for this particular purpose, and he used it for this purpose.
Okay. That will
so it conveyed it's just like his body. Personality. It conveyed Yahweh's personality, his proclivities, his attitude, his aptitude. A lot of what Yahweh was conveyed in that particular mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
That's clear. I just didn't want to be on some. I didn't want to miss something like that and start everybody.
There are a lot of things that you want to be really careful because the natural tendency is to mislead by saying it. And so I want to be really careful on this one. So the answer was yes and no. And the yes is important and the no is important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yes, it's Yahweh's soul, but his soul versus our soul.
Another,
they're not in the same league.
Yeah, you're right. I got it now.
You know, our souls are essential to who we are. The Yahweh soul is not.
I got you.
Now, it existed to fulfill one purpose, and that was to go into Sheol during Matzah.
Right.
That was its only purpose.
There is no indication of any kind that any of the spiritual beings, like the Malach, the Shama, have souls.
Now, that makes sense to me, too. Yeah.
And so Yahweh is a spiritual being, as the foremost spiritual being, there would be no reason for him to have a soul other than as an implement for this particular purpose.
Amazing. Jesus. I don't know what everybody else is talking about, but all this stuff is really cool.
Yeah, I think it's really cool. Yeah, it finally kind of sunk in because what you have to realize is that the prophecies, particularly in Yashayah, that speak of Yosha, they do not say that a virgin will give birth to a child.
No, I know.
It's funny to know that Ahaz, and it's just saying, for you, idiot, this is the best I'm going to give you because you don't deserve anything more. You know,
idiot of all time. He says, "What do you want?" And he says, "Don't worry about it."
I don't worry about it. So he says, "Okay, idiot. Then all I'm going to give you is a young woman is going to give birth to a child." You know, and then Yashayah 9:6 is, just an ordinary woman is going to get pregnant in the ordinary way and deliver an ordinary child. Yosha was an ordinary person.
Mm-hmm.
Through the time that the spirit came upon him in the Yarden River. And then...
Now, there's a reason we're not told anything about that part of his life by anyone, because it was completely irrelevant.
It was pretty ordinary.
It's irrelevant. It's irrelevant.
You weren't germane to the whole story.
Right. Yeah. Irrelevant. Yeah, in fact, I don't even know if we could trust the old story of he walked into his... You know, he walked away from his...
Yeah, yeah.
We're all searching for him. And that was about my father's business. I don't have a problem with the story. It's just inconsistent with the
it definitely seems out of place.
But I'm sure in his lifetime he had to know the Torah pretty good.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean he had the Torah.
He
walks in and he pulls to Isaiah, and he says, "Today this is fulfilled."
This is fulfilled right before your eyes.
This guy knows his stuff.
Yeah, he knows his stuff. Well, the spirit had the spirit on him at that point too.
That too. Yeah, that too.
Yeah, the but.
We usually want you to be somewhat prepared.
No matter if Yahweh's soul represents 1/1,000,000,000th of what he is, it still carries Yahweh's personality, Yahweh's proclivities, Yahweh's interests, Yahweh's nature. It carries that with it. That makes it pretty extraordinary.
Yeah,
right?
Indeed. Indeed it does,
Yeah, it does. And that means that so much of his attitude we ought to pay attention to. And he, when people said, won't you heal me? And he said, come on. Leave me alone. Or if I'm going to do this, I'm only going to do it because maybe you'll look to what's really important if I do this menial thing for you. And, what's the first thing he did every time he was surrounded by a lot of people? Fade into the woodwork and leave.
Got away.
Yeah. You know, those things can't play at the First Baptist.
No.
He's thinking.
Not
he's the one to get away. That's everybody be throwing rocks at you. Get out of here, boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I just said, come on. Nobody wanted to hear
But that's him. True. That's true. It's exactly what he says. And, you know, he says, take me away. And he walks across and gets in the boat and leaves to the other side of the river.
Right.
I mean, the other side of the sea.
The largest audience he ever had.
Yeah, obvious.
And the largest talk he ever gave was his first.
Mm-hmm.
Went downhill from that. You know, what we call the Sermon on the Mount? That was the biggest.
That was the big crescendo. Yeah.
Right. And nobody wanted to hear what he had to say after that. Yeah, he was very unpopular.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, guys,
he'd be every bit as unpopular today, maybe even more so.
No, yeah.
I tell you, I
he'd be run out of any church he went into.
Imagine all these
you said in the last few weeks has been when you, all of a sudden it struck me. So when y'all returns, that's 99.whatever% of the world population will be dead.
Dead.
He is so mad and nobody.
Yeah, he said that there'd be so few people left that he'll probably be able to count them and write the number down.
And that's what we're saying. When you start doing the numbers, you go, wow.
Yep.
I mean, as a human being, as people who don't like to see death, you know, even in animals and things, that's just staggering. But that's so be it. That's the way it has to go.
That is the way it's going to be. It's,
mm-hmm.
Not many. But I was not ever been impressed with numbers. And I mean, look through everything he's ever said and done. It's never about numbers.
He was down for just one.
He would have been happy as a clam, as you say. Well, he couldn't be happy as a clam because that's no good thing. But he'd be just happy as he could be with just Adam all by himself. But it wasn't good for Adam.
No.
So, he created T'Challa. That was better for Adam. He did what was right for the first God that created his image. Yeah, exactly. For his nature.
Okay, all right, gentlemen.
Shalom.
I talked to Dr. Jeff the other day, and he says, he always says, shalom, shalom to me.
Shalom, Dr. Jeff, great guy. One of my favorite people. All right, bye-bye.
Okay, y'all. Take care.
Talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.